Welcome to Grimshaw Speakers, a partnership between the Grimshaw Club and Beaver Sound. We bring you conversations with exceptional individuals discussing the issues of our times. On December 2nd, Grimshaw hosted an event on the women of Kashmir with Amina Mahmoud-Mir, a doctoral researcher at the Center of Study of Democracy in the University of Westminster. This event aimed to understand the daily struggles of women in the valley in an effort to expand the discourse of international security beyond the military and weapons.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of Grimshaw Society, I'd like to welcome you to the Women of Kashmir event. Thank you so much for joining us. Please keep your microphones on mute to avoid any disruptions, and feel free to turn your cameras on as we want this to be as interactive as possible, and we've kept plenty of time for questions. Kashmir is one of the most complicated and contentious regions in South Asia. Nuclear armed neighbors, India and Pakistan, have fought over it since 1947. In the process, the voice of the people of the valley has been suppressed and they have been systematically disenfranchised. In the conflict and in efforts of peace building, women are neglected and underrepresented. So this event aims to understand the daily struggles of the women of Kashmir. Our speaker for today is Amina Mahmoud-Mir. She is a doctoral researcher at the Center of Study of Democracy, University of Westminster. Her research project focuses on the right to self-determination and regional politics in the Kashmir conflict. She is also interested in education, diversity, and mental health. She supports initiatives addressing issues of gender equality and domestic violence in the former state of Jammu and Kashmir. She has been trying to understand the conflict for the last 10 years and has traveled, lived, and engaged with young people and scholars in both Indian and Pakistan-administered Jammu and Kashmir. We are very grateful that she has taken time out to join us today. Before we dive into the discussion, I have a small request. If anyone has been following the news for the past 2 years, they'd know that the situation in Kashmir is quite dire. So I'd just like to request that if you have the means, please donate on the link that I'll be putting in the chat box in a minute. And if you do donate, don't forget to send screenshots to Grimshaw's social media handles. We're active on Instagram and Facebook. Just give me 1 second and I will put the link in the chat box. There you go. Amina, the first question I sort of had was, could you set the scene for us? Why is Kashmir such a complicated issue, and why are there no easy solutions? Why has the Indian government not been able to, or rather is not willing to, fulfill the demands of the people in the valley?
Thank you so much, Tanvi, and thank you so much, Grimshaw Society, for inviting me. I am very pleased to be here today, and I am very happy that we are discussing these important things. So your first question is very important, that why this issue is so complicated and why Indian government is not able to resolve it, or they are not willing to resolve it. So I think, in my opinion, and I have said it before this as well, that first we need to understand what is this conflict. When we say the Kashmir conflict, we need to say whether it's just Kashmir or there are other regions as well. So I think when we name this conflict as Kashmir conflict, we just ignore the existence of other people. We don't recognize that other regions do exist. So first I would like to tell people, I know it's a very basic thing, but so many people don't know it, that the former state of Jammu and Kashmir had 5 regions at the time of partition in 1947. And I will not go before, you know, what happened before 1947. So I think that's the main year, so main event. So I will talk about it. And so at the time of 1947, there were 5 regions: Jammu, Ladakh, Kashmir, Gilgit-Baltistan, and Punjab-Jaggir. So when partition of India and Pakistan happened, and then there was this massive political change in the region, so then we know the history of this conflict. So now, Jammu, half of Jammu, Kashmir, and Ladakh province, they are administered by India. And then Gilgit-Baltistan, half of Jammu, including Punjab-Jaggir and one province of the Kashmir region, or which is Muzaffarabad, they are administered by Pakistan, and it's commonly known as AJK and Gilgit-Baltistan. So that's the context of the area. So I think to understand the complexity of this conflict, we need to understand the geography of the area, like what kind of regions are there and what kind of people are living there. So commonly people don't understand. Obviously, Kashmir has been highlighted in the news and then in academic and political discourses because of massive human rights violations. But then other regions, in my belief, they have equally suffered because of this conflict. Maybe the nature of their suffering is different, but we can't ignore their suffering. I don't believe in comparing their sufferings, but I want to acknowledge their sufferings as well. So I think that's the first complexity that people need to understand, that they should acknowledge the existence of all the regions and all the people in this conflict. Second, I think the important thing is to understand why this conflict is still unresolved. The problem is, I think many scholars have said this before me as well, and I just want to repeat the word that the focus of this conflict and all the debates is India and Pakistan. We don't want to talk about what people of these regions are feeling. So the main people, the main stakeholders, they have been ignored for a long time, and they never got any opportunity to be part of any negotiation or dialogue process. Even if we look at the United Nations resolutions, they never asked any Kashmiri representative or representative of other regions to be part of negotiation. They went to India, they went to Pakistan, they wanted to know their position and what they want to do, but then they never gave importance to the people. So again, the center is the people, which have been ignored for a long time. And I think in my opinion, that's the reason this conflict has been unresolved, because you don't want to engage with the main stakeholders. And if you talk to people, maybe in some regions, people don't even feel that they will be asked to be part of the dialogue process. They don't have even hopes from the states that they will ask them to be part of it. As far as India is concerned, I think especially what happened in India after 2014. Now we are seeing the consequences of that decision that people made in 2014. So now I think it has been made, the nation has been brainwashed that, okay, your main concern is Kashmir. Your main concern is Article 370. Your main concern is what if women have all the rights in Kashmir or not, or if people have development in Kashmir or not. So rest of the India, what happens there? If there are floods, if there's pandemic, it doesn't matter. But what happens in Kashmir in Article 370, that's important. So this issue has been made kind of very important in the lives of a common Indian person, like a common Indian who have nothing to do, who may not go to Kashmir ever in his life or her life. So they have been told that, okay, that's the most important thing in your life. So when you made this thing, and when there is lack of education, when there is lack of awareness, then people don't question these decisions. So then they buy these logics and then they believe them. So I think now it has been made that, okay, that's our pride, that's our national pride. So when it becomes a national pride, then it's very difficult for political leaders and nations to take a decision which goes around against their national pride or sovereignty, which in Kashmir's case, India claimed that Kashmir is their national pride. So I think now that's another reason that they don't want to resolve it, that Indian government is not concerned whether this conflict is important, and especially after Shimla Agreement, they don't even recognize this as an international conflict. So they think, so the establishment says that, okay, that's our internal issue, we will resolve it. So when you don't even want to recognize that is an international issue, then you don't feel the need to resolve it. So I think now, in my opinion, that's the stage where the Indian government is, that they don't feel that there's a need to resolve it. And I don't think it will change unless there is a change in the mindset of the people, unless they realize that they have been used, they have been told that this thing is very important for them, but it's not, because it's not their life. And they need to understand, you know, Kashmir is not just a place, just not a territory. Actually, humans live there and they have regular lives. So when we will have this humanistic approach, I think maybe then we can maybe have little hope that this resolution of this conflict will come from Indian side. there is another side as well, and I don't know when they will have this realization.
Firstly, sorry I put you on the spot asking you to summarize such a complicated issue in such a short span of time, but thank you for that insightful response. It really helps us set the proper context for this discussion. So the next thing I wanted to talk about is the unique forms of violence that Kashmiri women face in their day-to-day life, and how this has affected their physical and mental health. What are some of the most urgent issues that are being ignored?
I think there's an answer. The answer of this question is in your question. That's the mental health. I think that's the most important thing that we should try to understand. So in my opinion, I think the Kashmiri women, they face all kinds of violence, whether it's emotional, whether it's sexual, physical, structural, all kinds of violence is there around them. They have to deal it every day. And there's no moment when they were not being realized, okay, we are there to inflict violence on you, pain on you. So they face this. So I think in recent times, and imagine it's been 70 years, more than 70 years, if we include the Dogra rule or the colonization periods before that. So it's a very long period for any nation that you have been facing all these atrocities for more than a century. So it affects your mental health in various ways, and it develops the society in that capacity as well. So what Kashmiri women are facing, of course, state violence is there, and it's not in one form. If we talk about the recent censorship, no one can't even read, you can't write, you can't speak, you can't express yourself. So physical and sexual violence is there. There have been incidents like Kunan Poshpura in the past, where soldiers went into the village, and then they raped all the women, and then killed some of them as well, and the men as well. So I think they have faced these things, and one is state violence, what women face every day, but then there is social violence as well. What they face is at their home, what in their atmosphere. So they are, I think, when I say that women are facing various kinds of violence, so I think it's a very complicated thing in itself, because it has multiple layers. So of course, state violence is very, linear thing, and we can understand, okay, state is doing this and that. But other kind of violence like sexual harassment, sexual abuse at workplace, so these are very normal things. So I think the women in conflict, and the women, especially in Kashmir, so when they go out, so it's not only state, there are various faces of different kinds of violences. So we have to understand the political violence, which is there. It's very open. It's very visible. It's out there. But then there are kinds of violences which are not visible, so which we need to understand. And I think when we try to understand the women in the conflict areas, we need to go beyond the political violence, because that's not the only important thing. And the kind of violence that they everyday face, this is different. Like the patriarchal society, it's the main thing is in the Kashmir. Like the domestic abuse is very much there. If you say it's not there, that's not right. And then they have to deal with these things. And then the women have to raise their kids, and they have to raise their children. They have to go out to drop them school, come back. But then the spaces are so militarized. They are so violent. They can't really have a normal life. So I think this conflict, of course, the women are victim, but they are survivors. And I think they are not weak. In my opinion, they are not weak, because surviving in such a highly militarized zone, facing domestic abuse, sexual harassment, online cyberbullying, all these kind of stuff, and then militarized violence. And I think it makes you very strong. But I don't believe in glorification of violence and then resistance as well, because I feel they're not supposed to face all these things. They're not supposed to face these challenges. It's their survival. So there's no glory in their misery. So I think, yes, so Kashmiri women face a lot of issues, deal with it. But if you see, I don't know if you have experience or not recently, but women are doing amazing jobs, amazing things. They are very much they are achieving good goals in the education sector. They are getting highly classified scholarships. Then they are starting their own businesses. So they are facing violence and all kinds of other issues, but they are moving forward in their life as well. So yeah.
Thank you so much for that. I think in mainstream discourses, it's so difficult to come by these issues. So thank you so much for your response. I wanted to talk about the mass arrests that have happened since Article 370, which has led to, in most instances, men and boys being put in jail under the guise of the Public Safety Act. In a lot of these instances, the family is not given accurate information about where the detainee is, whether they'll see them again, and just when they'll be released. How has this crisis impacted women, especially their economic security, and how has the pandemic worsened this situation?
It affected women a lot because it increased their responsibility as a person, especially when men generally picked up by the army or police. So they used to lodge them into Kashmiri prison and cells. But what happened after 5th August, for the first time, or not for the first time, but it happened in many other cases, but this time on mass scale, they put men into the jails and prisons in other states of India. So that was very difficult, especially for single women, to go out of Kashmir, then to look for their loved ones, where they are. There are so many states when you don't know. For instance, let's suppose my brother has been picked up. I don't know where he is. I go to all jails and prisons in Kashmir. He's not there. Then I go out of Kashmir. But then I need money to travel. I need accommodations to stay if I go out of Kashmir. But I don't have any money. I have a family to look after as well. So these are practical implications of the mass arrest, which happened after 5th August. So for them, there are many stories of women who face these things where they had no idea about their loved one, like where is their brother, husband, or father. So they had no idea about them. And then they were going off to look for them and then to know where they are. So then it's not an easy thing. And there were incidents where a single mother who had no sorts of income went to see his son, and then she got to know that, okay, he's not in Kashmir, but he's in another state. And then, she had no money. So she asked, you know, the friends of her son that, you know, you guys go and then tell me where he is. And then they used to help her, and then they used her financially as well. So that's the story of, I think, almost every woman in Kashmir who is facing this kind of issue. And then they are victims of this state violence. So they are only surviving because of the help which they get from their neighbors or relatives. And that's very rare in most of the cases as well, that, okay, your relatives can help you, but not all the time. So eventually you have to be there for yourself. You have to be there for your children. And then especially in this pandemic, when all the travel was banned and you can't go there, and all the prison was, they all the prisoners are still in the jails. So there were many appeals by activists, by political people, that, you know, at least release these people, send them back to Kashmir so that their families can know where they are. And prisoner, they actually died in the jails because they were old. They were mostly 65 plus. So when you pick up these people who have done nothing, and you are not telling what they have done, and then you just pick them up and then you lodge them somewhere in any state where with their family don't know anything. And the other a very heart-wrenching event was when a guy who was picked up by the army, and then he was released after 20 years, and he came back. His mother was not there. He died. There were other incidents where the women who are part of the APDP, APDP is Association of Parents of Disappeared People. So there are some old women who died looking for, they still opened their door, you know, their son is coming back. So they are incidents that it's generally very difficult. First, it's a very traumatic experience. Like, you don't know where your loved one is, where is your son, where is your brother, where is your husband, where is your father. And then second thing is the economic aspect of it. And then you have to look after yourself. And then in some of the cases, women had to rent some place because they had no place to live. So, and then pandemic made it worse. They have to look after themselves. Or for instance, if some woman is so old, 60 or 70 plus, and his son is in the jail, they have picked it up, then how she can travel? She can't travel. And now people are scared to go outside as well. So that's an added struggle for them. So this pandemic actually made things worse for people in Kashmir. And if I remember correctly, when everything started this year, when people, of course, there was lockdown in Kashmir, and Kashmir was surviving. And these, I don't know how many lockdowns. So then there were so many appeals of donations. And then people, I clearly remember that some people actually helped 500 to 600 families, sometimes 1,000 families in a day, who had nothing to eat, who had no food. And majority of them were widow, and the people and the single mothers who had nothing to feed their children. So these important things we need to address them. We need to know that when we talk about the resolution of the conflict, we need to understand that that's the important thing, because it's affecting the lives of human beings there, especially women and children. Living in a traumatic environment is a very difficult thing.
Wow, I think that paints a really bleak picture and really humanizes statistics. The next thing I wanted to talk about was that recently traditional social structure and gendered hierarchies have been retained, but at the same time, public spaces have become more available for women to don more political and militant roles. I was reading about this young girl who was inspired by Banksy and graffitied political messages on public walls. So could you tell us a little more about this process and the dichotomy it presents? Have these changing roles been a force of liberation for women, or has it been a way of increasing oppression?
Yes, I am aware of, you know, the new form of resistance in Kashmir. And I think when you don't have any democratic space, when you don't have any democratic space where you can express yourself, you look for any medium through which you can express yourself. And I think the art has become a very much expressive medium where people are expressing their feelings, their ideas, what they feel. So this, I have read the story of this girl, and I think it's very inspiring, where you know how much risk is there, but you are willing to take the risk. And I think it's the expression that even on the walls, the young people of Kashmir, they're writing, especially the girls, that you are not welcome here. So it's an act of resistance in itself. And I don't know if you know about Zanan Wanan, there's a very recent thing. It's a group of women who are doing the same thing. They are singing resistance song. They are also writing on the walls what they are feeling. And then they have recently issued a very good issue as well, where published an issue where I think women from different fields of life, they come together. Most of them, they all are Kashmiri, so they have expressed themselves in various ways. Some have told their stories, some wrote poetry. So I think I would like to share the link in the chat box as well, or maybe if you can send it to other participants. So I think that's a very recent thing, and it's very good that women, and especially young girls, they are coming out and then they are telling their stories. And these are acts of resistance. I think not always the one who pick up the gun is the person who is showing some kind of resistance. I think there are different forms of resistance, and then people really don't question these forms, and then they are very supportive of all of them. But I think what happens in terms of art, it's very incredible. Songs, poems, then paintings, then these kind of graffitis. I think these all are form of resistance, and people actually went out, because I think at times I also think why these things are becoming more and more visible, and then why young people are going towards these. And the thing is, most of the time Kashmir is under lockdown or there is curfew. there's no physical space for people to go there, for young people to go there, have some fun or do something or express themselves. So what they do, they write stories, they write poems, they write songs, sing songs, and that's how they express themselves. And obviously when you are indoors, that's the kind of things that you can do. So I think they are doing whatever is in their capacity. And I think it's also a message that no matter how much you suppress us, we will do whatever we can in whatever capacity, even if we can just lift a finger, that okay, but it will be an act of resistance. So that's how I see the latest forms of resistance in Kashmir.
That's so inspiring. And to think that most people are my age, it blows my mind that people have to go through that, but they're still so strong. The next thing I wanted to talk about was how Kashmiri women can be included meaningfully in peace building dialogues, which is sustainable and in an inclusive manner, and why it is so important to include them. And one other thing, if I could add, what would be some of your policy recommendations to alleviate some of the most pressing concerns?
Yes, I think that's the most important thing to do, because I think in my lifetime, or if I have studied whatever happened before me, I have never seen any woman leading the negotiation process or dialogue process. Right now, people have even stopped talking about it because they don't see any hope. But I think we need to talk about it, about the resolution more, because that's how we will move forward. And I think the inclusion of women in the dialogue process is very important. In Kashmir's context, there have been no inclusion. And if I remember the previous dialogue process, when Indian government was talking to, you know, in their, like, what they call separatists in Kashmir. So they are not only men separatists. So obviously, Hurriyat conference was there, but then there was Dukhtarane Millat as well. So they are, whether you like their ideology or not, that's another thing. But then there's an entity as well, and there women are following them and they are part of them as well. So when you want to have a dialogue process with Hurriyat conference, then why you are not approaching women organizations like Islamic or Women Center in Islam, or then in there are some other, you know, women organizations as well. But the main, the one who is very famous is the Dukhtarane Millat, and everyone almost knows, like, you know, what kind of organization is and what's their manifesto or agenda. So it's very clear. So I think it tells that even when nation states want to include people from these region into the dialogue process, they don't consider women. They think that they are non-actors. They don't have any part. They don't influence anyone. So we don't need their opinion. But I think it's very important to include women. And when you, what would I recommend to them? Which I highly doubt they will ever do. But I would like them to include women from all the regions. They should, and they are incredible women. They are writing, they are speaking, they are there. It's not that they are not capable of. And if you listen, even what people think, that they are not properly educated, or they never went to university, so they might don't know anything, but they have faced this conflict. It makes them more educated than all of us, because they have been living there. They know what kind of challenges they face and what kind of arrangement they want in the future, because women raise their children. Even the people who are very much vocal these days, obviously their mothers raised them. So I think they are very important to be included in the dialogue process. So first, I think it should go to regional level. They need to include women from all the regions. And they are, I think, what Natasha Cole gave a testimony last year. And it was a very powerful document. And when you look at it, so I read it, and then there was some recommendations. There were long-term recommendations, and then there were short-term recommendations as well. But I didn't see anyone talking about it. Just because it was given by a woman, so no one cares, like, okay, we don't care if someone is talking about the resolution. But if some just random guy just writes some tweet, everyone just go gaga, oh wow, how nice, we should talk about it. And all the media outlets just talk about it. But I was just wondering, because I do work on, you know, conflict resolution, and I do think about it. And I was like, why no one is talking about it? Because it's a very much there. And I actually liked it. So when women participate, when they share their thoughts, no one wants to listen, no one even gives them importance. So I think we need to, maybe in our academic spaces, we can do this, we can involve more women into conflict resolution workshops, and then listen what they want to do. But especially, I think the most important thing, specifically in women's context, I think they should be included in the dialogue process on the regional level, and of course then men as well, because in other regions they are not even considered. For instance, Gilgit-Baltistan, no one has ever asked why they are not included in the dialogue process, because they are very much part of it, but they are not there. So I think they need to go to regional level. I think there are incredible women out there, and their input is very much valuable.
Thank you so much. I'd just like to ask one more question, and then we can open the floor for discussion. Why do you think it is so important to discuss Kashmiri women or issues of women generally, if you're a scholar of international relations or politics or something along those lines?
Yeah, so I think it's very important, because first you get to know what women in Kashmir are feeling, or the women who have seen these things, or women who are connected to these issues in any capacity. And I have recently realized, like, I have seen the work done by Kashmiri women, like the EPW issue, then the book written by, I think it's an amazing book. This is by Athar Zia, The Resisting Disappearances. I read this book and it's amazing. And then there's a book by Isar Batul. Do you know Kunan Poshpura? So they have done incredible work. Then there's Insha Malik's book, Muslim Women, Agency and Resistance Politics. So these are important, the important work which you have seen recently, it's all done by women, and no one is actually giving them credit, and no one is talking about them and how important is this work. And if I can give you one example of Isar Batul's work, so I listened her interview which she gave when she launched this book along with other co-authors. So she was saying that majority of the researchers, they start their work and they go to Kunan Poshpura, and then they ask them question, how you feel, what happened to you, and all these questions. So then women there, they were very irritated that people just come, they ask us questions, they don't do anything. But Isar said that we collected all the information, but we first registered our case. We said that we will fight for you. They started the legal battle. And then when they were fighting for them, then they got all the, you know, information, data, and there were so many things. Then they thought, okay, let's write a book about it. So that's how they wrote this book. So I think in Kashmir, it's very important to understand the work done by the Kashmiri women, because they are not just writing it. They have experienced it, and then they are writing their experiences, and you can actually feel it from where it's coming. And just to make it more clear, I just want to read a paragraph by Insha Malik. She wrote this in her book, Muslim Women, Agency and Resistant Politics, The Case of Kashmir. She said that the struggle of young Kashmiri women who have metamorphosed into an expression of resistance through writing offer a critique of the discussion about the modes of resistance. Sometimes nonviolence is projected as a better way of fighting for a cause, but the young women see no dichotomy in the methodologies that people use to resist the dehumanization of the occupation. Through writing, women challenge the class hierarchy within society and strive to present their own perspectives. After 2010, writing dismantled the space between the writers and sufferers. When Tufail Mattu, a teenager, was murdered in cold blood in the summer of 2010, his sister immortalized him in an obituary. Razia's son, whose father was killed in a fake encounter, writes poems about it. The Kashmir of today is sinking in the oppression and lawlessness of the occupation. The exploration of resistance politics in Kashmir shows women in Kashmir have never been silent victims, but resilient witnesses, narrators, and secret writers of freedom. I think that's all that I want to say, that, and it covers everything, and it's very powerful as well.
Thank you so much. I completely agree. That was really powerful. I'd like to open the floor to questions. So if you want to, you could just raise your hand and ask your question yourself. If you're not comfortable, then please put the question in the chat box and I'll ask it for you. Ashutosh, do you please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Amina, for sharing your experiences. It's always great to hear from someone who has been on the ground and can share her first hand experiences. I had a couple of questions. Number one was, I think as an Indian, what one thing which is definitely missing for the mainstream or for the so-called Indians is that there's a huge communication gap, right? We just don't know about what's happening in the Kashmir, and we simply don't know anything about what's happening in the Pakistan side of the Kashmir or the POK. So maybe if you could shed some light on the situation in the Gilgit-Baluchistan region, that's number one. And the number two question was around the solution to this conflict. So you mentioned about the fact that the solution has to be international, in the sense that all the countries need to come together and get a solution. But I've always felt that the kind of diplomacy which India enjoys at a global level, it's very difficult for any international community to intervene in this, right? As we saw in Article 370 case. So I personally feel that the solution has to be an internal dialogue between India and Pakistan. But if you could just elaborate or share your views on whether the solution has to be an international thing or an internal thing. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you, Ashutosh, for your question. I think your both questions are very important. So first, I would like to, I think, talk about the Gilgit-Baltistan and what we call AJK, or what is commonly known as our POK. I think the situation is little bit different there. But, you know, I think, yes, there is a communication gap and no one knows, you know, what is going on. And that's why I think the regional perspectives are important. So in Gilgit-Baltistan and in AJK, so that's how people, natives actually refer the regions as. So they have different set of issues. So they have administrative issues. There are human rights violations as well, which are not as grave as Kashmir, but they are there. There is no freedom of expression. You can't express yourself. So censorship is very much there. That's why you don't hear much about it. The local people who are there, they can't even express themselves freely. Of course, they can say, but in their limits, because they know they have to live there as well. So that's another point. And when they say something or they show resentment, they were told, look, we are not killing you like people in India are getting, people in Kashmir are killed by India. So that's the level of human rights violations there. But I think the level is there. For instance, if I give you an example of Gilgit-Baltistan, people were put into jails for protesting, and they were protesting to be part of Pakistan. They genuinely want to be part of Pakistan, but then they were protesting for it because they can't. They said that we can't be part of this conflict. We chose to be with you. So why you are not letting us be part of you? So they were protesting to be part of Pakistan. And then they were picked up by the state, and then they put them in the jail and then slapped them with the terrorist charges. Like we have FSPA and all these laws there in Kashmir. Similarly, there are laws in Gilgit-Baltistan or AJK as well, where people people can't protest. They can't do anything. They are treated as traitor or terrorists in the region where they do something. And it's very important to talk about their issues and their struggle as well, which is very different from Kashmir. And but it's equally important. So that's about them. And I think they have suffered because of this conflict. And if you really want to know, I would recommend you to read Anam Zakaria's book. She has written a book about Pakistan administered Kashmir, focusing on Neelam Valley and all these areas. And it's a very important book. And you will know the different layers of religion, state, and then their struggle as well. So I think that's an important book that one should read. And recently there's another publication as well, where people from all the regions have come together. It's Islam, Society and Politics. It's edited by Serena Hussain. Then your second question is about the international solution of this conflict. I think internal solution, what you talk about, India and Pakistan, I don't think if they can resolve it, because the last thing that we had, it was Shimla Agreement, and the ever India and Pakistan came close to resolve it, it was during the Musharraf time. And that's the closest time that we were there, that they agreed to have an internal solution, and then they said, okay, there were 4-point formula that they will allow people from all the regions to travel freely, and India will and Pakistan, they will not control anything else, and then people will control majority of their issues. So that's the closest things that we had. After that, there is complete silence, and now not anyone is even talking about it. But I think international, it has to come from the United Nations. But unfortunately, United Nations is not even recognizing Kashmiris as an entity. They have to recognize Kashmiris as stakeholders, along with the people of other regions, Jammu, Ladakh, Gilgit, Baltistan. They all are part of this conflict. I think it should come from, and we have seen in the past that UK and US and all these major political actors, they have used this issue to deal with India and Pakistan. They really don't care about the resolution. Of course, for them, okay, if you want to get done something by India, if you want something from India, you're like, okay, we'll support you against Pakistan. And if they want something from Pakistan, they're like, okay, we will support you against India, and then that's it. So that's the thing. We need sincere efforts, and we need some responsibility. I think we need people to take responsibility for their actions, what they have done wrong in the past. I think that can be a starting point to start this resolution, including United Nations. They need to accept first as well that they have messed up this issue.
Yeah. Thank you so much. The next question is from Raja. How would one conduct fieldwork in such conflicted zones with censorship, requirements for permits, etc., especially with gendered spaces which tend to have further accessibility issues?
The one-line answer is it's very difficult. If you are not local, if you don't have any connection there, if you don't know anyone there, it's very difficult to go to any conflict zone, including Kashmir. But in terms of Kashmir, if we talk about both India and Pakistan, they are highly sensitive. No one gives you any clearance. They ask you a gazillion questions and ask you all, you have to fill so many forms. Okay, we are going there, we'll stay there, and then we'll do our research. Then you have to tell them what's your research is about. So it's very difficult, especially now what happened after 5th August. So I think there's no chance that anyone can go and then freely do any kind of research. It's very difficult, and then it's not easy to do research, and it's even for locals, especially if we talk about what happened recently in Delhi or in Kashmir, the recent raids where JKCC and ABD offices have been raided by the police and NIA. So they used to do an incredible amount of research, and they have done a lot of work. So, and a lot of people used to do internships with them, but now there's no space for this kind of work as well. So in the past, there was some space, but now it's very difficult, and especially In terms of, I think what I have heard from other researchers, female researchers especially, who went to Kashmir and who have done their research, they didn't have any bad experience, I would say. I mean, they had easy going, and Kashmir is generally, I mean, if military is not there and militarization is not there, so people are generally friendly, and then they help you with all the things and you make friends, and it's very easy to make friends in Kashmir. So connections are not, or networking is not very difficult. So from people, it's not very difficult. And especially I know people used to give testimonies, and people have participated in many researches, and I can understand. I mean, if I live in any conflict area and if anyone comes to me and asks me same question again and again, I'll be very irritated. I'll be like, why you are asking these questions? But then I am amazed, like, but some people in conflict areas, they want to tell their stories. For instance, when I was interviewing people for my research, they wanted me to write down everything. They said, we want you to share our story. So that thing is there. So people want other people to listen to them, listen to their stories. So in that way, people in Kashmir are super friendly, and then they have participated in many researches. So I would say from people, you don't have anything to worry. They participate. And even the victim survivors of Kunan Pushpura, they have gave interviews to so many people. So they even despite their trauma, their sufferings, so people participate, they help you, they tell you what they have felt in their lives. So, but from state's point of view, now it's impossible. It's kind of impossible. If you are not native, if you're not local, then it's very difficult for you to go there and then do research. It's very risky and dangerous. I would not say it's very risky and dangerous because you will not get permission in first place. So, yeah.
Thank you. If Jyoti, you had a question, I hope I said that correctly.
Yeah, that's correct. Thank you. I'm audible?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Anima. I definitely agree with whatever you mentioned, because I have personally worked in Kashmir, with Greater Kashmir, with Vyas Kandusnath. And my specific question, concerning the women who have been living in Kashmir as stateless citizens. I mean, for example, in 2010, there was an act which was introduced by the Indian government to rehabilitate the former militants. And at the same time, there were many women who were married to these militants. And especially at the time when the 370 has been scraped off, and even though we have a case in the High Court, what happens to it now? Because it's such an uncharted territory that no one, and at the same time, it's been over a decade that they have been stripped off of their citizenship, either from Pakistan or either from the Kashmir, and it becomes very difficult for them to even have the basic rights or even follow a basic livelihood.
Yeah, thank you so much for your question, and it's very important. So I am aware of some of the cases, and I have been following these protests when people were protesting. I think it was last year when some women were protesting that, you know, they want to go back. So there were militants who married women from HAK. So technically, they are part of the same state, right? They are not anywhere. So they are part of the same state, but they don't have any rights. So they were protesting, either give us citizenship or send us back. But no one was listening to them. They went to, I think, Amit Shah's office as well. They filed so many applications, and then some women organizations were helping them as well. But then there was no solution to their issues. And I know one case particularly. So there was a woman who married to a guy in Kashmir, but she was a Pakistani, and she was facing domestic abuse. And she then decided to separate from her husband. And then she contacted State Women Commission last year, when State Women Commission used to exist. So now I think after 30th October last year, it stopped existing. And now there's no State Human Rights Commission, there's no State Women Commission. So I generally don't expect anything from these commissions. So when this woman went to State Women Commission, they tried to reconcile them. They're like, okay, you should talk to each other, then you can, you know, sort out your problem. And then the woman was saying, I am facing a threat, existential threat from this person, and you want me to reconcile. I can't reconcile. And then she was renting out some place. She was doing some kind of job, a minimal job in school, and then she was taken. And that's how she was taking care of her children. So this issue of stateless women is not simple. So there is no there are no shelter homes in Kashmir. If you are facing this kind of issue, you can't go anywhere. Police is not sensitized. I mean, they are not sensitized in any way, but they don't have any information, and they don't have any knowledge how to deal with such issues, and you know, issues related to domestic violence and domestic abuse. So these things, when you don't have any sensitization in the society or in the state or in the institutions, then it's very difficult. So these women are, I think, in a very vulnerable situation where, and you see in generally in South Asian societies, it's very difficult for women to exist as a single parent, and especially in Kashmir when you have to face the political violence as well. So then it's even more difficult, and there's no institutional support. There are no care homes where they can go, they can live with their children. So what I know of some women and what they have been doing to cope up, so they were going to some regional or native NGOs. So they were helping them by whatever they could, but there's no support for them. So I don't know when there are no state women commission. So I don't know how they will do it, because it's very, now they have to go to maybe Delhi or then to, you know, lodge all the applications and file everything there. But I think their first concern is to get some sort of citizenship. But with new laws, I don't think if they will get any. But they can't go back to AJK as well, or Muzaffarabad from where they came. And another issue is in schools. Their children don't get easy admissions there. So there's a stigma that, okay, your father was a militant. Even society made them feel, you know, that way. So they have to fight a lot of battles, and it's very difficult for them. Yeah, really.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I think we have time for just one more question. So someone wanted to ask about the role that religion plays in the conflict in Kashmir, and your opinion on that.
Sorry, I couldn't understand. What the role of?
The role of religion in the conflict in Kashmir.
Religion. It's an important thing, but it's not everything. It's one factor, but that's the thing about Kashmir, that you can't, there's no black and white. Even if religion is there, but it's not there. Like when if it's about the struggle, then it's properly political. Of course, the identity of the people who are asking it, they are majority Muslims, and religion do play a role, but it doesn't play, in my opinion, it doesn't matter if you are Muslim, if you are Sunni, or if you are Shia, even if we go into different sects in their religion. So when it comes to the right to self-determination struggle, then religion doesn't play as such role as many people must be thinking, that maybe the majority of the people in Kashmir, they are Muslim, so maybe that's why they are asking for separation. But then that's not the case. I think it started before 1947, the struggle in Kashmir, and it was based on the political ideologies and social ideologies, and it was all against the typical tyrant rules. So I think religion is not, in my opinion, it's not everything. But of course, there are people who are conservative, who are very much patriarchal. So all kinds of things are there. So Kashmir is not exception in that case. So things do happen, but like I said, there's nothing black and white. There are many layers, there are many complexities. You will find queer Muslim people in Kashmir as well. You will find very conservative, liberal people in Kashmir as well, who will pretend that they are liberal, but then in their acts, they will be very much conservative. And yes, so religion is not important, in my opinion. Yes.
Thank you so much. We have time for one last question. Ashutosh, if you can make it as quick as possible.
No, so I just had a small follow-up question on what Tanvi asked. So one thing with Kashmir, as from what I've read, is that historically Kashmir has been quite liberal when you compare it to other Indian Muslim areas. Also, like in general, liberal and also better off in a lot of other demographic indicators. But one thing which we also keep on hearing, and of course I would not disagree that it's a narrative which is propagated by the Indian media, is the fact that religious extremism has been on rise in Kashmir. So is that something which you would agree with, or is it something which is not really true?
No, if I would say that if you think that asking for right to self-determination is rising in Kashmir, the demand for rights to self-determination is rising in Kashmir, then it's not religious extremism. You are right, like in the mainstream Indian media, they say that, okay, the Kashmiri Muslims are extremists, and then extremists is growing. It's not extremism which is growing. It's their right to self-determination demand which is in rise, and people are asking it more and more. So when people say about that it's about religious extremism, I think they mix the identity of the person who, for instance, if I am a Muslim, I practice Islam, then they mix my religion and politics together. So that's not my problem. It's their problem that they are not able to understand what kind of argument they are making. And yes, I mean, this thing and then stereotyping of Muslims, it has been going on for a long time. And even if you see different documentaries that people have made and then they claim that they are radical, even in those documentaries, they only show Kashmiri children maybe wearing this Arabic scarf, then going into some mosque, and then in some madrasa sitting in there. But if you look at what happens in Kashmir, like people are very much educated, and then young people are, the literacy rate is very high. And I see people are pretty much modern, and maybe modern than many, many Indian states. And they practice, they are not conservative at all. So I think it's very unfair. I think it's Islamophobia. Like when you mix religion, you don't, if I am a Christian and if I am asking for my right to self-determination, you will not call me extremism. Or if BJP is practicing all Islamophobic or doing all human rights violations, you don't call it Hindu extremism in mainstream Indian media. So when people, you don't mix the religion and politics of other religion, but in Islam's case, it's always there. People mix religion and politics, but it's not a new thing. And I think we are used to it now, but that's really their fault, I think. But we need to talk about it, that you need to, maybe I think in Indian media, they need to get out of their prejudice mindset and their Islamophobic reporting in the media, and then stereotypical representation of Kashmiri Muslim, Kashmiri men, and all these issues. Yes.
Thank you so much for that. I think that's an interesting perspective that's often like not talked about. With that, we come to the end of this discussion. I'd like to thank Amina for her time and for how understanding she was with all the changes to the events, the rescheduling, the timing. So thank you so much. I'd also like to thank everyone who has joined in and for all your wonderful questions and your time. So have a good evening, and thank you so much for tuning in.
Many thanks to our speaker, Amina Mahmoud Mir, and to you for listening to this podcast. The music for this podcast was produced by Ash Lyo Masing. For more information on the Grimshaw Club in Beaver Sound, check out our social media and websites.